Ramon Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Prosecutors are requesting a substantial prison term for Donald Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen. He pled guilty to violating campaign finance laws by paying two women who claim past affairs with Trump. As you just heard on Take Two, Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff says Trump's possibly looking at post-presidency jail time if he personally directed those payments. The latest next. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you had a wonderful weekend. Such pleasure to have you with us today. Coming up, perhaps you've seen the story of the Good Samaritan who came to the rescue of a man hanging from the rain gutter of a home in Austin, Texas. Turned out the hanging man was a dummy dressed as Clark Griswold from National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. It was an elaborate Christmas decoration so perfectly executed, it fooled the caring passerby. Later this hour, we'll take calls from listeners who've had the experience of attempting to come to someone's aid, intervening in a dispute, helping out, only to find they misinterpreted what they were seeing. Alfred Norwood Jr., the man who warmed a lot of hearts with his intent to help that Clark Griswold dummy. But first, not a lot of warm hearts in American politics these days. Nonetheless, our political analysts are with us to come to our aid. Jack Pitney, Claremont McKenna College Professor of Politics, and Lisa Garcia Bedoya, UC Berkeley Professor of Political Science and Education. She directs the Institute of Governmental Studies at Cal. Professor Garcia Bedoya, good morning. Let me start off with you. With the latest in the Mueller investigation, federal prosecutors recommending a stiff sentence to Michael Cohen. Over his guilty plea on payments, he said, were directed from President Trump to two women who alleged affairs. Your thoughts on where Cohen and where this all stands?
Well, the president, of course, has tried to claim that this is a private transaction, that somehow the fact that he did this in the midst of a presidential campaign doesn't have any relationship to the campaign, which, of course, is not true. And it means that we have a sitting president that's being implicated in a crime, which is not trivial. And I think it's important to sort of take a step back and kind of look at this big picture and the place where we've gotten, where this doesn't seem to be such a shocking thing that has happened. And there's some sense of people sort of saying it's ho-hum and not that important. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But just because the president says that it's not a crime doesn't make it not a crime.
We also have conspiracy theorist Jerome Corsi filing a multimillion-dollar lawsuit against Robert Mueller, claiming that Mueller tried to badger Corsi into giving false testimony, that Corsi facilitated contacts between past Trump advisor Roger Stone and WikiLeaks Julian Assange. Corsi also suing over what he said were leaks from the grand jury testimony and what he says was illegal surveillance of him. Jack Pitney, your thoughts on the latest all going on with Cohen, with Corsi, Roger Stone, all of this?
Well, as Lisa pointed out, the president has been busy tweeting, and he writes, Democrats can't find a smocking gun tying the Trump campaign. No smocking gun. He misspelled the word twice in the same tweet. As far as Corsi goes, I've read his work, and based on that, I would definitely bet on Mueller. Mueller knows what he's doing. He's a very experienced, careful attorney, has a very strong staff behind him, and I wouldn't be surprised if Corsi's suit was just dismissed. He's in a lot of trouble, and I think eventually he's going to flip.
Democrats look at the Mueller report coming out. What do you think, Professor Jack, what do you think the threshold would be for Democrats pursuing impeachment of the president?
We're getting there. As Lisa pointed out, the documents last week, to put it bluntly, implicate the president of the United States in criminal activity. His defense, such as it is, would be that he didn't have knowing and willful participation in it. In fact, in a subsequent tweet, he said, well, lawyer's liability if he, Cohen, made a mistake, not me. But I seriously doubt that a jury would actually buy that if it ever came to a criminal trial. As far as Democrats go, it's getting close there. Again, a crime that we know about and probably more crimes in the future. The real question is, what would the threshold be for Republicans in the Senate? You can get an impeachment by majority vote in the House. A lot of Democrats probably in their heart of hearts are eager to do that. The question is whether you can get 2/3 in the Senate, which would require a substantial number of Republican votes.
And I guess I wonder if the payment to the two women, the payments, if there was evidence that Trump directly ordered those payments to the women, whether that would be sufficient in the Senate or even in the House. I mean, because we've certainly heard competing legal arguments on that issue. Not uncommon for people in, you know, prominent positions like that to pay people off to keep things quiet. Obviously, what's different about this is the timing is immediately preceding the election. It's during a campaign season. But I don't know, Lisa, your thoughts on whether that would be sufficient for moving forward with an impeachment?
It's difficult to know because impeachment is a political decision. It's not about criminal liability. High crimes and misdemeanors does not require that it be a criminal act. And so that it's a political judgment. And I guess for me, the question is, if the Democrats were to pursue impeachment, whether that would get the Republicans in the Senate to dig in particular, if they're able to say that the alleged violation or the alleged criminal activity is not sort of sufficient to cause or to be worth being removed from office. I think it's going to be interesting. I actually think what's going to be interesting will be the written testimony that Trump has provided now to the special counsel. And whether or not, given that we know that Manafort has been lying, whether they'll find that that in fact that sworn testimony is inaccurate or you know, a lie, for lack of a better way to put it. And that is exactly what Bill Clinton was impeached for, right? Lying under oath in a special counsel investigation. So I think it's more likely if we have these multiple instances of criminal activity rather than just one, that we'll be able to cross that political threshold where it's possible that Republicans will start peeling off and actually be willing to consider removing the president from office.
Lisa, let's talk about some of the personnel decisions in the Trump administration. We have his nominees now to be Attorney General. Former AG William Barr served back in George H.W. Bush's administration, and Heather Nauert as U.N. ambassador. There's been criticism that Nauert, you know, was a TV reporter and anchor, I believe, for ABC before Fox News, before becoming a spokeswoman for the State Department. Your thoughts on the confirmation for both of these nominees?
Do you mean the likelihood
the
of
likelihood,
confirmation?
Yeah. And what we're going to hear during the process.
I mean, I think clearly, given the makeup of the Senate, I don't see them having difficulty being confirmed in the end. I think there might be some difficult questions asked. I do think on the question of our U.N. ambassador, it really does bring home how little this president believes in diplomacy and how little he believes that there's a skill set or a knowledge base that is necessary in order to engage in that activity. On the one hand, in the reports, they're saying that the U.N. ambassador, of course, is the public face of the U.S.'s position vis-a-vis the U.N. But that role is also a lot about building relationships and with countries and doing a lot of backroom conversation and really having the pulse on what's happening in the world diplomatically. And to do that, you actually have to know something about history and diplomacy and international relations. And so the fact that we're willing to have someone who's telegenic but doesn't have the knowledge base that's necessary for that role, I think, is troubling, but chances are she will still be confirmed.
Now, Nikki Haley, I'm trying to recall, Jack, obviously, you know, she'd been a governor, so you'd seen her political expertise at work, but I don't recall that she had much in the way of international experience, and I think was generally perceived to have done a good job. So your thoughts about Nauert, you know, versus Haley?
Yeah, the issue is judgment, knowledge, and broad experience. Again, as you mentioned, Nikki Haley had government experience, as did George H.W. Bush when he became U.N. ambassador, though at the time he was not heavy on diplomatic experience. So the issue with her is how much does she know? There is a precedent for naming a journalist to this job. President Nixon named John Scali, who had been a correspondent for ABC News. The difference was that John Scali was a very, very experienced diplomatic correspondent, had actually been a go-between during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So there was no question about Scali's knowledge. In the case of Heather Nauert, I'll be curious to see how she does in the hearings. There was an embarrassing moment that long ago in which she cited D-Day as an episode in the long history of German-American relations, which might have come as a surprise to people who knew something about World War II.
We're talking with Jack Pitney, Claremont McKenna College professor Lisa Garcia-Bedoya, UC Berkeley professor, talking about the biggest political stories of the past several days. Nick Ayers, who's been the chief of staff to Vice President Pence, will not commit to spending two more years in the Trump administration, the president considering him to be the chief of staff after John Kelly's departure. But Ayers apparently will not be that person. Jack, can you speak to the significance of this choice for the president and how skittish people might be to take that job?
Yeah, you really, in the modern presidency, you really need a very strong and effective chief of staff, particularly when you have a president who pays no attention to detail. That's the job of the chief of staff, to run the White House, pay attention to the details. And this indicates not only Ayers, but some other names that have come up who've declined interest, that they don't see this job as very desirable. And that's understandable given what happened to Reince Priebus and John Kelly. As with so many people, they ended up with diminished reputations, in fact, downright humiliation. So for somebody especially like Ayers, who's young and politically ambitious, he probably reckons accurately that this job would be a career killer, not a career maker.
Well, and even under more typical administrations, I think of this job, Lisa Garcia-Bedoya, as one where you kind of have to be the bad person. You're the person saying no. You're the gatekeeper. You're, you know, Rahm Emanuel, we think of as sort of, you know, almost the extreme example of the person in this position who, you know, doesn't mind being, you know, the tough guy in that role. Your thoughts about the willingness to take this on, particularly in the Trump administration?
I think Professor Pitney is absolutely right. I think the difficulty is, yes, you have to play the bad guy and you're supposed to be the one ensuring that the president, people don't have access to the president that shouldn't. And so in the first instance, the fact that you have members of the president's family that are always going to circumvent whoever the chief of staff is difficult. But the second part of this role is to staff the president and to give recommendations and to have the trust of the president that those recommendations will actually be heeded. And I think that's it seems to be, at least from the reporting about Ayers, that was the secondary issue, was that You have to have a plan and you have to have be the bad guy. But in the end, you need to have the president trust you and actually do what you ask them to do, because you have reasoned judgment about what should be happening. And there's no indication that this president is willing to go along with his chief, regardless of the quality of the information being given or the empirical foundation upon which whatever recommendation is being made.
Lisa, where do you think they're going to find someone to take the job? Or do you just think there's always someone who will take this job? It's just too high profile to turn down.
I mean, I'm sure they will find someone, but it is a little insane that it would be difficult. There were a number of people mentioned in the reporting over the weekend who've indicated that they don't want the job. And so maybe someone who's masochistic and imagines and has enough hubris to think that they'll be the one to actually hold this man back. I don't know, but it is unimaginable, or it's odd to imagine a situation where this wouldn't be seen as a coveted role, but in fact as something that potentially could destroy your career.
Yeah, Jack, if one of your past students, I know you've had a number of your students move on to prominent positions, if came to you and said, "I've been offered the job," what would you say?
I'd say run away as fast as you can. This is not something that would be good for you. The political consultant Rick Wilson wrote a book, "Everything Trump Touches Dies," and that is only a slight exaggeration. If you look at the number of people who've passed through this administration in staff jobs, cabinet jobs, almost all of them have ended up with severely damaged reputations, and it's quite possible some of them will end up in jail. Just stay away.
Jack Pitney, Claremont McKenna College professor, Lisa Garcia Bedoya, UC Berkeley professor, our two political authorities joining us to talk about the top political stories. Coming up, we're going to look at the case of the Chinese phone manufacturing company Huawei and its chief financial officer Meng Wanzhou, who's been imprisoned in Canada. We'll talk about the impact of that on U.S.-China relations, and we'll take a look at the ongoing controversy in that North Carolina congressional race where there have been allegations of what's called vote harvesting. We'll talk about that, as well as what Republicans have said about all the late votes counted in California's congressional elections. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. Back in just a minute. Pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. Every Monday, we bring together two political experts, differing perspectives, to share with us their thoughts on all the developments in D.C. as well as here in California. This week, we're with UC Berkeley professor Lisa Garcia Bedoya, professor of political science and education. She directs Cal's Institute of Governmental Studies. And Jack Pitney, Claremont McKenna College professor of politics. We turn our attention now to the congressional elections, the midterms, where still there is an outstanding House seat in North Carolina, allegations that there was what's called vote harvesting, or efforts to try and pressure votes to come in support of the Republican candidate there. Meanwhile, there have been a number of op-eds. Sean Steele, former Republican Party, had an example of this, writing an op-ed in the Orange County Register, calling into question what Democrats have done in California to try and make it easier to register to vote, and at the same time making it easier to pressure people to vote a certain way. Lisa Garcia Bedoya, your thoughts, first of all, on, you know, what we're seeing in North Carolina as well as here in California, just, you know, the polarized political landscape sort of fueling this.
Well, yes, in North Carolina, it looks like this is a political operative who's done this before. If you looked at the analysis of the elections that he's worked on, he has somehow magically gotten overwhelming support among absentee ballots that was disproportional to the support in other places where he wasn't working. So it does seem that there's some potentially fraudulent behavior. Correct. In North Carolina. In California, I think it's really important to say giving people access to the franchise should not be a partisan issue. We should make it easier for people to vote. The United States has one of the lowest rates of voting of any advanced industrialized country. I think what Secretary of State Padilla and the legislature has done in terms of facilitating voting with automatic voter registration, conditional election day registration, and the fact that we have 16 and 17-year-old pre-registration is good for our democracy. It's not something that should be about partisanship. And so, you know, the fact that it took a while for us to know what happened in the election is, in fact, a good thing, because it means the state is taking seriously that people have the opportunity to cast provisional ballots, and then they're going to take the time to make sure that those ballots are valid and that they're accurately counted. And I think we should all think that that's good for our democracy. It's good for the state, so that people actually have their voices heard in a way that hasn't been true in the past.
Although, just in terms of the practical advantage, all of these efforts do help Democrats. When you're pre-registering teenagers who are much more apt to vote progressive than they are Republican or conservative, people who've served time in prison, who are able to get their right to vote back that they didn't used to have available to them, they're going to be, you know, ending up voting more Democratic, more likely than the general electorate. So, I mean, there is a practical advantage here to Democrats.
But the point is that these people are people who have the right to vote and should have the right to vote. And in fact, the fastest growing voter party identification among our electorate is, in fact, declined to state. So, in fact, both parties have problems with the new people who are coming into the system. And I don't think it's automatic that young people, if the Republican Party had policies and practices that appeal to young people, they would vote for Republicans. So to say that there's a partisan advantage because somehow youth are naturally more Democratic isn't true. It just so happens that the policies being pursued by the Democratic Party appeal to those voters. The Republicans are perfectly able to appeal to those voters as well and perhaps get them to choose. I think both parties should be concerned about the fact that most young people don't affiliate with a political party because they feel disaffected and don't feel a connection to either one.
So they vote Democratic, but as you say, they don't want to be labeled as Democratic. Jack, your thoughts on the critique, again, looking at both these states and how the parties are flipped in the critique.
Well, here in California, the outgoing Republican chair, Jim Brulte, to his great credit, acknowledged that there really isn't anything in this in the state of California to allegations of misconduct or voter fraud. As he points out, the problem is, and for a long time, Republicans have just failed to broaden their base, failed to recruit good candidates and appeal to the demographics of California as it exists in the 21st century. And if the problem, the tragedy of the Republican Party is that more people didn't listen to him. He's been preaching this for years and years. And yet they went in a Trumpist direction and they paid the price in 2018. In North Carolina, it's pretty obvious that really blatant election fraud happened here. And if there isn't a new election, that would be a travesty. And I seriously doubt that the House will seat the Republican. There's almost certainly going to be a new election.
So how much damage does it do to the reputation of Republicans, Jack, to have them claiming it's suspicious that, you know, the later votes that were counted went heavily Democratic in California without any evidence that there's any fraud associated with that, anything other than the fact that the Democrats tend to vote later, that they turned in more provisional ballots, and that's just kind of the natural flow of who votes when?
Yeah, it's bad in a couple of different ways. One, you just look dumb by making these unfounded allegations. And two, it's the crying wolf phenomenon. Yeah, there are actual problems with absentee ballots, as we're finding in North Carolina. And someday there might, in fact, be some kind of election fraud. But then when Republicans actually try to call it out, nobody's going to believe them because they've been saying nonsense right now.
Jack Pitney, Claremont McKenna College professor, Lisa Garcia Bedoya, UC Berkeley professor, with us on Air Talk. We have China-U.S. relations seriously deteriorating in the wake of the arrest of Meng Wanzhou, who's the chief financial officer of Huawei, the phone manufacturing tech company from China. She's being held in Canada, where she was changing flights in Vancouver. Lisa, your thoughts on where we stand and the potential that she is going to be charged for trying to circumvent the U.S. sanctions against Iran?
Well, I think it's likely it seems to be likely that she's going to be charged. And it's a very delicate moment in U.S.-Chinese relations. And this is a very powerful company within China, and she's the daughter of the founder, so it's personal for the people in charge of Huawei. And it does speak to many of the concerns that the Trump administration has been stating about the way that China engages in its business practices. And so I think it's unlikely. I think there's a reason why, you know, the indictment came through in August and now she's being arrested in November. I think there was probably some consideration of how to go about doing this. But I think now that she's been arrested, it's very likely that the indictment will go forward. And then the question on the back end is how that affects all of these negotiations with trade that the administration's currently undergoing with China.
Jack, how do you see this unfolding?
Well, there are really legitimate issues with China on trade and technology, but as far as the broader issue of trade and U.S.-China relations, it comes down to a war of attrition. Which side is going to be able to stay standing? And the United States is taking a hit. We have a growing trade deficit with China. Although Trump thinks that trade wars are good and easy to win, Impact on the United States is already showing up, and ultimately a democracy is much more vulnerable to public opinion than an authoritarian government. So I wouldn't necessarily bet against the Chinese.
Lisa, let's take a look at the upcoming 2020 presidential campaign. It's an enormous field of potential Democratic candidates. What do you think is the realistic timeline? The candidates need to have their fundraising machinery in place, and they need to be making soft declarations that they're running.
Well, the conventional wisdom was now. Right, that people needed to already have some major donors lined up before they announced that they needed to already be spending time in places like Iowa and New Hampshire. I think the open question is whether the change in campaign financing, in the sense of the advent of online fundraising and the ability of candidates to actually raise significant amounts of money from small donors rather than just having to depend upon large donors, whether that's going to change that calculation in terms of timing, because in some ways that fundraising tends to happen once you have more momentum. It's not something that you would necessarily be able to be counting on now. And then the other question is really what kind of candidate is going to be able to go up against Trump. I think a lot of the current analysis is sort of assuming the same characteristics and kind of resume that you would expect from a traditional candidate. People like Hickenlooper because he's folksy. But I'm not sure that any of the folks in the field have the kind of wattage necessary to stand up to Trump. And so it'll be interesting to see how these more traditional politicians are able to change their imagery to be larger than life in the same way that Donald Trump is in order to be able to compete.
Was it Bruce Springsteen who about a week ago said he didn't think there was a Democratic candidate at this point who'd beat Trump?
I think a lot of people have said that because he is a larger than life figure. You know, love him or hate him. I mean, he tends to suck all the air out of the room. And so I don't know if kind of a, you know, very by the book politician who speaks in a certain way and just has been trained to engage in issues the way politicians have, I'm not sure that they can actually effectively be a counterbalance to just the largeness of his personality.
Of course, with the Mueller investigation, you know, with the investigation concluding, we don't know how much damage there will be on the Trump presidency. Jack, your thoughts about the timeline for Democrats getting serious about their runs?
Yeah, I think it's right that they don't necessarily have to announce right away. Again, campaign finance has changed. The big issue for Democrats is the kind of candidate they want. Is it going to be somebody who will get in Trump's face, be sort of the doppelganger Trump, or is it going to be somebody who is as unlike Trump as possible? If the former, a lot of people are still rallying behind Bernie Sanders, possibly Kamala Harris or Cory Booker. Or if they want to go for this somebody who's as unlike Trump as possible, full declaration, he was my student, is Governor Steve Bullock of Montana, who has a very deliberative bipartisan approach. The question is whether that is going to be sufficient to rally Democrats in the primaries. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, all of these, I mean, the names are well known to us. But when you look at the Democratic field, you get past, you know, two, three names. These are not household names. Yes, everybody knows Bernie Sanders and everybody knows Joe Biden. But, you know, not everybody knows even these senators who are considering runs, Jack.
Yeah, though I do recall a conversation I had in 2005 with a student from Illinois who was talking about Barack Obama running for president. And I very wisely said, well, he has a great future ahead of him. He's a young man, but it's not realistic to think of 2008. So sometimes people can become household names quickly.
All right. I want to thank you both, as always. Appreciate you talking politics with us on this Monday Air Talk. That's Jack Pitney, Claremont McKenna College Professor of Politics, Lisa Garcia-Bedoya, UC Berkeley Professor of Political Science and Education. She directs Cal's Institute of Governmental Studies. Coming up on Air Talk, we open up the phone. Maybe you heard last week the case of the Good Samaritan who came to the aid of the man hanging from the rain gutter at an Austin, Texas Texas home, only turned out the man who was hanging from the rain gutter was a dummy dressed as Clark Griswold from National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. But the feel-good story of the Good Samaritan went viral. Have you ever had a case where you tried to intervene to be helpful in a situation, not even trying to save someone's life, but trying to intervene only to find out you misread what the reality of that situation was? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Back right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. I think a lot of us can relate to the experience of seeing something happening before us and being concerned about what we're seeing, whether it's a dispute or a child in potential peril, or even in the case of the story last week, someone appearing to hang from a rain gutter with the ladder well out of reach. So what do you do when you're in a circumstance like that? Well, retired veteran Alfred Norwood Jr. decided he needed to come to the aid of what appeared to be a man dangling from a rain gutter in front of an Austin home.
Hey, hold on. All right. Can you reach it? Can you reach it?
So he went to the aid of what ended up being a dummy. It was an elaborate Christmas decoration done in tribute to National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. The dummy was dressed in the very same clothes that Clark Griswold, Chevy Chase's character from the film, wore when he slid off his roof, grabbed onto the rain gutter, and held on as he was hanging his Christmas lights, his ladder kicked away to where he couldn't reach it. The couple that put up the decoration said they'd gone to thrift stores. They had looked for just the right kind of shirt and pants to put on the dummy, and it was so realistic that Norwood, seeing this, decided to try and help the man and came to his aid. 911 was called. Well, and the Good Samaritan and the couple who'd done the decorations met up afterwards. The couple gave him a gift card and thanks and touted his Good Samaritan act on local television news in Texas after that. My question for you is, you know, if you've been in that position, you've seen something that caused you concern. Were there ever a case where you came to understand you'd made a mistake, you misjudged that situation? Matt D'Angelo-Antonio, our AirTalk producer, who's actually line producing right now, he had the experience. He was walking down the street to get lunch out in front of our studios and sees our colleague, Michelle Faust, walking down the street and a guy yelling at her from across the street. And she was in front of the guys yelling at her. So Matt goes up, is everything okay? And she said, oh, it's just my brother who was gone. Have you ever misassessed the situation, tried to intervene because you thought there was cause for concern, to find out wasn't like you thought? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Robert in Mission Viejo, what's your experience?
Hello. Well, many years ago, I was working at Disneyland, and a couple of young ladies ran by me. Looked like they were having a lot of fun, as people do at Disneyland. And one of them dropped her purse. And so I called after her to stop, but then she didn't hear me. So I picked up the purse and ran after her, but she was much too fast for me, evidently, and I was unable to catch her. But then a few minutes later, I learned from Disneyland security that she was, in fact, a purse thief and had stolen this from someone else. And evidently, I think she was trying to get rid of she'd taken probably the cash out of the purse and was trying to get rid of the evidence. And so I was very close to returning stolen property to a criminal. I guess I would have been aiding and abetting.
Robert, that's a great story. Can you imagine if you'd been a track star and had caught her and handed it back to her and only to find that out after the fact?
Yeah, that would have been horrible. So that was my one. It was very much a Clouseau-like moment for me.
Robert, I but it's a great story. I love it. Yeah, good Samaritan trying to help the robber. Thanks so much. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I haven't actually had anything like that happen to me, but I can think of so many cases where I've almost intervened. And then just really, oh, wait, I misassessed. It was not as I thought it was what was going on. Like sometimes you'll even, you know, think people are arguing and realize, oh, no, it's really not an argument. It's something, you know, just an animated conversation. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Fed Up writes on the page, someone called 911 when I fainted in a store once. I was not happy. I didn't want to see them. Even worse, city sent me a huge bill for the services. Why should I be charged for someone else calling for something I didn't want or need? That's Fed Up writing on the AirTalk page. Candy joining us from Santa Clarita. What's your experience?
Hi. So I didn't actually do this myself, but I witnessed it, and it was pretty funny at the time. I was walking my dog, and a coyote comes running down the street, and a man is running right after the coyote, and he yells out to me, "Do you know who this dog belongs to?" And I shouted, "It's a coyote," and he stopped dead in the street. It was hysterical.
All right. Doesn't belong to anybody. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Carrot and Seal Beach said back in the 90s, when ABC was using its blimp, they're probably covering a football game or something, I thought I saw a UFO, so I called the network only to find out it was the Goodyear blimp. I had never seen a blimp before. All right, Karen. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Andrea in Hollywood, what's your Good Samaritan experience that was based on a faulty assessment?
Well, it was, I was walking into the Target in my neighborhood, and I had spent many years as a substitute teacher, so I had kind of gotten accustomed to telling kids what to do who I didn't know, because it's always a new group of kids. And as I was walking into the Target in West Hollywood, it has a very high wall that's on the second floor, and there was a little kid sitting on top of the wall. And had he fallen, he would have fallen like 25, 35 feet.
Oh, my goodness.
To a concrete floor on the bottom. And I was actually talking on the phone to my friend, and I said, "Hold on a second, I got to yell at a kid." And she said, "Yell at a kid? What kid?" And as I got to the top of the stairs, I just said, "Hey, get off of there," in my like angry teacher voice. And the kid jumped down from the wall, turned around and looked at me and said, "Sorry, Miss Ruth." He recognized me immediately as his teacher.
That's so funny. Your teacher instinct kicked in. Little did you know it was literally your student. That's great. Andrea, thank you so much. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We're talking about the feel-good story of last week where retired veteran Alfred Norwood Jr., seeing a person dangling from a rain gutter, runs up, tries to get the ladder that's not accessible to the person dangling from the rain gutter to get it under him, tries to break it free of Christmas lights, calls 911, yells for help, only to find out it was a dummy that was hanging there. Very sweet story of someone trying to help and asking if something has happened to you where you thought you were looking at a dire circumstance or someone was in need or that you needed to intervene to provide, you know, protection to someone, only to find out it wasn't really what you thought it was. Curtis in Santa Monica, you're on Air Talk.
Hey there, Larry. The first day I moved into my last apartment, there was a really heated argument, it sounded like, going on. It was really, really bad. It went on for hours. I called the police. They came and investigated. It turns out the family wasn't fighting with each other. They were on the phone yelling at their cell phone company.
Oh, we can relate to that.
Yeah.
So they were yelling at the cell phone company, and it sounded like an argument.
Yelling, like and it went on for hours. It was going on. I waited. It was my first day in the apartment. I waited a while before I called the police on any of my new neighbors.
So did you talk with your neighbor about this afterwards?
I did not. I spoke to the police officer right there, and he said, hey, you know, you did the right thing. Like, I understand.
Yeah.
Because they were, even as the police were pulling in, they were yelling, and it was really animated. They were really, really yelling.
Well, Curtis, I love that story. Thank you. Thank you so much. 866-893-KPECC. And yeah, you can understand if it's your cell phone company, your cable company, you can understand a very heated, animated conversation. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Similar story from Susan in Hollywood. She said she was living in a Hollywood bungalow and thought her neighbors were having a domestic dispute. She walked over to try and break it up, always a dangerous thing to do. Turned out actors were rehearsing a scene. 866-893-KPCC, maybe in Edward Albee play. We'll be back with more in 1 minute on Air Talk. Charlene from Silver Lake said, when I moved out to California a few years ago from New York, I was driving on the 5 and there was a CHP vehicle in front of me, and it starts weaving back and forth and back and forth. She called it in. She thought it was a drunk CHP officer. She'd never seen a traffic break before. That's a great one. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. When have you played the role of a good Samaritan or responsible citizen only to find out you misassessed what was going on? 866-893-KPECC. Barbara in Sherman Oaks says, I was sleeping in my car and I heard a mom and child arguing outside whether they should call 911 because they thought I was dead. Barbara in Sherman Oaks, 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let's see. Dawn in Burbank. Dawn, you're on Air Talk.
Yeah, hi. I was driving on the freeway and there was an SUV, and underneath it was this what looked like a little infant girl hanging by her dress, just barely missing the pavement. 15 miles I followed them in the direction I didn't want to go. Finally, I pulled them over when they got off the freeway, and the guy got out and said, oh, it's my daughter's doll. Thanks very much.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I've seen those little dolls that are, yeah. So you got your heart back in your chest, and were you angry about it?
Felt a little foolish, too.
All right, Don, 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Adrian in Hollywood, when have you intervened only to realize it was under the wrong pretense?
Well, I was living in an apartment building where I could see across the way directly into the apartment across from me.
Oh, like Rear Window, the Hitchcock film.
Precisely. I noticed one morning the freezer door open. And that night I noticed it was still open. So I sort of went through a little thoughts in my head, worrying that maybe something had happened to this girl who lived in the apartment across the way. And I decided to go check on her. So I walked across the way. I had never met her before. I nervously knock on the door, don't hear anything. I wait, knock a few more times. And then finally, I walk down and I contact the building manager. And I asked about the girl who lived there. And apparently she had moved out in the middle of the night. So everything was fine. And I had these horrible images in my head, but it turned out okay.
Yeah. And you just reminded me that whole film, Rear Window, which is like the scenario where you were living in your apartment complex, is about whether, of course, a murder actually occurred across from not. And you as the viewer are not certain what really happened because you only see what the resident of the apartment sees.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Adrian, I appreciate it. 866-893-KPECC. Jack writes on the page, my friends and I were coming out of the water in Ventura after surfing. We see a woman being attacked and yelling. We thought she was being assaulted. We dropped our boards, ran up to the perp, who looks up, sees about five large, angry surfers surrounding him and shouts, wait, wait, it's a movie. It's a movie. Turned out they were doing a student film on the beach. 866-893-KPCC. Jamie in Laurel Canyon, your story of mistaken help.
Yeah, I was walking my dog a few years ago, and I saw some what I thought was smoke coming up from a house. So I took my cell phone, and I called the fire department, and fire engines came rushing up. And it turns out it was just some morning dew coming off a person's house who turned out to be a celebrity. So essentially, they thought I did a celebrity swatting. And then, like, the police called me, and they
asked me
why I called, and I felt really embarrassed.
Oh, I can understand. And I've seen what you're talking about, where that kind of the fog light comes off the roof or a deck surface as the warming morning sun interacts with the moisture. And yeah, and it does look like smoke. You're absolute. So I see how you would make that mistake. But yeah, the celebrity swatting thing where people, claim that someone's being held hostage inside a celebrity house. We've had, terrible examples. Even deaths that have occurred from that response. Jamie, thanks. 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. We're talking about the case of Alfred Norwood Jr., Good Samaritan from Austin, Texas, who's seeing what he thought was someone dangling from a rain gutter with the ladder out of reach, runs up, tries to get the ladder under the person, calls 911, yells for help. It was a dummy, part of the Christmas decorations. And that story has touched a lot of people. We're talking about if you've had an effort to help someone end up to be based on a misunderstanding or misperception. Let's see. We have a number of people. This course in L.A., you'd only hear this on a program like Air Talk in Los Angeles. Bennett in Silver Lake saying, I was in L.A. City Hall, saw a man running down the hall, someone chasing him. One man had a gun. I panicked. I tried to ask council member about it. And again, filming at City Hall. Kelly in Glendale, your experience with this.
Okay, well, I have a middle schooler who is usually pretty studious and responsible. And I was picking her up at a sporting event, and lo and behold, she didn't do the sporting event. And so I got parental on her and said, that's not responsible. You need to go to your sporting event. And she turned to me very upset because she was being scolded, but also something was in her mind. And she said, well, I'm contemplating suicide. And I said, what? So as a parent, I freak out. And I'm like, out of my mind, kind of, oh, I don't know what's going on. And lo and behold, what happened is that she had an assignment given to her from school to research this book called 13 Reasons Why. And everybody in the class was thinking about the consequences and the extraordinary.
Yeah, so she was thinking about suicide, not committing suicide.
Well, and being a preteen, maybe not being able to communicate that.
Yeah, yeah.
Fluently, it would make any parent kind of go, what triggered this? And so I panicked. So, yeah, it was all in good meaning, but it was not the same situation.
Yeah, and here's your own daughter. Yeah, and getting the wrong impression. 866-893-KPCC. Jeffrey in Hollywood, you had the other side of this. What was your experience?
I was watching TV and opened the door, and there were, cops and fire departments in front of my door. And they basically said a Samaritan was walking by with her dog, and there was so much torturing in her house. And I swear to myself,
Jeffrey, you're cutting up. I'm sorry, but I know you were going to say your wife was editing a horror film at the time. They were hearing the screams from the film, not a real person. Let's see. Dennis in Long Beach. I was having dinner at a restaurant in Hollywood. Car was backing out, trying to help the woman, and in the process of helping her, car went forward, hit another vehicle, all as I was trying to help. We'll have more coming up on the second hour of Air Talk. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Hope you had a great weekend. Hope your day's off to a strong start. Coming up a little bit later, we have one of those terrific BBC reporters. I always love talking with them. They're so entertaining as they describe these major events in the UK. And major events there were this morning. Theresa May, Prime Minister, addressing Parliament and getting a very testy response to the Brexit plan that had been negotiated by her administration. They pulled back on the holding the vote in Parliament today. But we're going to hear a bit of that and talk about what comes next for Theresa May and her administration on Brexit. First, it's what happens here in the city of Los Angeles, where tomorrow the council is poised to vote on new rules on Airbnb short-term rentals. It would put limits on the number of days a year that someone could rent out their principal residence. And at the same time, the issue of vacation rentals has been raised. Whether people who have second homes or investment properties, whether they should be able to rent out those properties as vacation rentals. Because that has rental advocacy groups very unhappy, saying it's going to take units otherwise available for people to live in full time out of the market. With us from Airbnb, the LA Region Deputy Policy Manager, Connie Janos. Connie, thank you for being with us. Where does your company come down on these proposed limits?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me, Larry. I think what we've been saying for a long time now is we really want to see clear rules in place for short-term rentals that allow the city to actually best address its concerns. And housing is chief among those. But vacation rentals actually have been a longstanding part of the city of LA way before short-term rental platforms ever came into the market. And in fact, we just recently in October did an analysis because we really wanted to look at what the impact of vacation rentals was on the housing stock. What we find is that already LA has over 13,000 vacation rental properties that are designated as vacation rentals. That's far more than what exists in the full-time short-term rental market. So what we really believe strongly and we're encouraged by right now in the direction that the conversation is going is that putting some rules in place on vacation rentals will actually help better control for the housing market. It will have clear rules in place. There can be some controls on growth to best address the concerns of the housing advocacy community, which we understand. And it will really also address some of the neighborhood character concerns that come up sometimes in this discussion.
Let's take a concrete example. So let's say that you have an apartment building in Venice, highly desirable location, and you're having the units that are rented out as short-term rental units for vacationers. What sort of limit do you think is appropriate for a building like that?
Well, I think, number one, I think we've been talking to the city about there may need to be ways that you can control for growth in a particular building, right, so that you're making sure that you're not having the sort of turnover that allows for an entire apartment building to be turned into short-term rentals. That's not something that our company has ever supported. I think that there are also ways in which the city could put controls, for example, on how many permits an individual could have so that you don't have that dynamic. So if you own a building, maybe, you know, you live in one unit and you can share that unit because it's where you reside, and maybe you'd have the opportunity to do an additional unit, and then the rest would have to maintain in the long-term rental market. That's one way that the city could address its concerns. I think the city could also look at, do you want to put controls on the overall number of permits that you want to have citywide? Because, again, I think it's really important to understand that the data around this, vacation rentals have existed in L.A. far before short-term rental platforms came into the market. So you are actually talking about implementing some rules that controls for activity beyond what you find just on platforms like ours.
I think what the difference is it used to be vacation rentals were really, in clear resort sort of areas, neighborhoods, oceanfront houses, things like that. Now, because of the platforms that make it so much easier, you have people who are entering that area that just never would have been there before. So it's sheer numbers, right?
The sheer numbers actually show that we haven't significantly grown the vacation rental industry in LA. So when you look at the growth patterns, we haven't necessarily created a big spike in vacation rentals in LA. I think what you see is people transitioning into short-term rental platforms that maybe before were using, you know, the Penny Saver or exclusively using websites like Craigslist. But I, you know, going back to how does the city do this in a way that is also inclusive of housing concerns? You put controls on how many permits are allowed, and then you can do both, and you can actually better enforce on the activity and on the bad actors that I know are such a concern for housing advocates. If you don't have clear rules, if you just ban it outright, what we have learned is that a lot of this activity will go underground, and the city will not be able to implement and reach a lot of its policy goals that we want to definitely support it with.
Ganayanos of Airbnb, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so
much. Also with us is Cynthia Strathman, who is Executive Director of Strategic Actions for a Just Economy. It's a tenant rights and housing organization. Cynthia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So what are your concerns about what's drafted in the short-term rental regulations and the vacation rental package?
Well, our primary concern right now is that they've been linked in a way that will delay the implementation of the currently drafted short-term rental regulations. And those regulations were passed unanimously by council last May. Since they've been passed without having been implemented, we've seen about 2,500 more homes that have been removed from the city's housing stock. And this is at a time when we're seeing a real shortage in housing, a real spike in homelessness. You know, the zip codes near Sage down here in South LA are some of the most overcrowded in the entire United States. We really need that housing, and we can't afford to delay this ordinance, you know, indefinitely while we draft a vacation rental ordinance. We really need this ordinance on the books now, and they actually should not be linked. They're different types of problems, and they need to be addressed in separate ways.
Now, tomorrow, what do you think's the likelihood of how this is going to be dealt with by the council?
Well, I'm very hopeful that council will, you know, take their responsibilities to the citizens of Los Angeles seriously and pass the ordinance as they originally agreed to back in May. You know, Airbnb is a giant corporation. They're making a lot of money. They have, you know, fancy corporate headquarters. They have beer and wine taps that come on at four. But I don't think that the well-being of that corporation should be the priority. I think the well-being of the citizens of Los Angeles and the residents of Los Angeles really needs to be the priority here.
Of course, you've got competing points of view of residents because you've got a lot of people who want to earn some extra income by renting out their property through a short-term rental platform, and other people who believe the character of their neighborhood has been damaged or they can't get into housing because units are out of the market. So, I mean, there is, you have to admit, there's a split here of people's interests. It's not just Airbnb against the world.
Well, I think that the number of people, that there's a very broad coalition of folks who want to see this regulation passed. I think that there's homeowners, you know, in parts of the city that have been really impacted. I don't actually usually work with those folks that much. We really represent extremely low-income tenants, especially in South Los Angeles, who are being impacted by the housing crisis. I know the hotel industry is very concerned about it. They're actually working with the hotel employee union, which isn't an alliance you frequently see. So I think if you add up, you know, tenants, homeowners, hotels, people who work in hotels, it's really most of the city who would like to see this regulated. I think the only people who are really concerned about the Airbnb regulation from the other side are people who are directly profiting from Airbnb transactions. And even then, you know, Larry, most of those folks will not have any of their activities curtailed by the regulations that are being proposed, because most of the small operators on the Airbnb platform and on other platforms would still be allowed to move forward with the kinds of rentals that they're doing. It's except that now they'd be regulated and they'd be legal. You know, currently as it stands, they're technically illegal. And I think that a lot of the small operators would really welcome some sort of regulatory certainty around this. So I think that, you know, saying it's a split when there's so many more people who live in the city who really want to see that regulation is pretty generous.
All right. We're talking with Cynthia Strathman, who's Executive Director of Strategic Actions for a Just Economy. Let's talk with Al in Hollywood. Al, what do you think of the proposed regulations limiting number of days and types of properties that can be short-term rented?
I think it's great if they can enforce it, but I don't see it happening. I have a friend who lives in Hollywood Hills off of Beechwood Canyon. He has the house across the street was a 5-bedroom house for 30, 40, 50, 60 years. 6 years ago, it was flipped into a 5-room micro suite hotel that has not paid a penny in taxes in 6 years. It's $300 a night. He sold out almost every night, has no off-street parking, and put up illegal no parking signs to reserve spaces for his quote-unquote guests. It's $3.2 million gross receipts in that last 6 years. It has been repeatedly reported by multiple people to – going back to Tom LaBonge when he was council member, they've done nothing.
And so you think even if they pass this, it's not going to be enforced?
The code enforcement says, well, we can't prove that it's a hotel or not. I can show them websites. They were the place is even featured in Sunset Magazine. Thing was a hidden gym.
Not so hidden. Al, I appreciate the call. Cynthia Strathmann, do you think that, an ordinance would deal with something like this?
Well, what we're hoping for is platform-level enforcement, which means that instead of having to send people out into the field to determine what's happening with every single unit, which would be very difficult, that we can partner with the city can partner with the platforms to have them share the data with them so that they can regulate it. You have to have, be registered as an operator in order to be able to even be able to register your unit on the platform itself, which I think would hopefully address some of these concerns about the regulatory effectiveness.
All right. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Bob in Toluca Lake, you're on Air Talk.
Oh, hi there. Look, I've owned a vacation home down at the beach for a number of years and have never had a problem get along with all of our neighbors. Traditional vacation rentals have been around long before Airbnb was even a thing, and it become a critical part of our travel system, our travel economy. These are not party houses. They're not taking affordable housing off the market. And people are sharing their homes with families from around the world. That's a blessing. This is what we should be doing more of, and should not be criminalized. And this ordinance has fines up to $2,500 a day. And where's the justification for that?
Bob,
I really hope tomorrow that city council makes the right choice, make the right decision, and includes vacation rentals in this current ordinance.
All right, Bob, I appreciate it very much. Cynthia, you want to respond to that?
Well, I think you need to think of this in terms of, for one thing, I if it's a vacation rental, I think that speaks to the idea that we need to take some time to really think about how vacation rentals are going to be regulated and not try to hitch them to another ordinance that's about people sharing the homes that they live in. And I don't think that, anybody wants to see folks rush into a regulatory a system for vacation rentals without really giving it, the appropriate consideration, which is like yet another reason to not try to link these two issues together. People have talked a lot about wanting to welcome people into their homes. I mean, there are a lot of people in Los Angeles right now who don't have homes who could be, use a home to be welcomed into. And we had one of our members who was asked to leave his home with his two little kids, who's a low income resident. And he doesn't really have very many options on where to go. And his landlord wanted to take that unit and convert the entire thing to an Airbnb unit. So while I'm not, necessarily against welcoming families from all over the world into the city, I think we do need to make it a priority to house the people who actually live here.
We're talking with Cynthia Strathmann, who is Executive Director of Strategic Actions for a Just Economy. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Susan in Santa Monica, what do you think?
Yeah, I like that last point. We should make more of a priority for people who actually live here. I live and work in Santa Monica. I've been renting for the last 5 years and trying to buy a home, and it's really, really frustrating when you can't afford to buy a home, even though you work at a great tech company and you make all this income you think you could. But when you pull open your Airbnb app, you see that all over surrounding you, there's all these wonderful homes and condos that are just permanent Airbnbs that people are renting out. And so it feels like all this wonderful housing has been taken off the market for people like me.
Susan, do you think it's realistic to separate out vacation housing from the short-term rental market, that they can be made separate and distinct? And or do you think the city just needs to, you know, look at stringent regulations on both?
I think it needs to be both. I don't think you can look at them separately, but I'm really not an expert, so I really can't say. All I can really speak to is that a lot of people just like me in similar financial situations, we really want to live and buy a home in the area that we work.
Susan, I appreciate it. Thanks so much. Anne in Inglewood, you're on Air Talk.
Hi. I was calling because I think that the Airbnb, a lot of the people who use Airbnb are just regular people trying to make some money because it's expensive to live here, as everybody knows, and having that extra income, I think, is a good idea. And I don't like having people come in and tell you that you can't do that. And also, I had a friend whose uncle owned like a huge building, and they said that they kept a portion of the apartments not occupied so that they could write it off for tax purposes.
So you'd like to see that enforced?
Hmm?
So you'd like to see them go after that and force that, you think? But you think that there needs to be more consideration for short-term people who have their units short-term rented?
Yeah, I do.
All right, Anne, appreciate it. Let me go back to Cynthia Strathman. So what happened? Let's say that the council doesn't pass the measure tomorrow. Then what's the next step?
Well, then I think that we really need to encourage them to try to pass something as soon as possible, because every day that we delay this ordinance, we're losing more and more housing. And it's not to the small operators who want to rent out, you know, rooms in their own home. We're talking about big commercial operators who are coming in, renting out multiple apartments and turning them into erstwhile hotels. So I think it will be really important to communicate to council how necessary this is as a way of preserving and housing in the city of Los Angeles.
And just clarify, we're talking about a 120-day limit for short-term rentals under this ordinance?
There is actually a way that you can get an exception to that if you want to rent more. So there's a limit, but it's not absolute.
All right. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much.
Cynthia Strathman of Strategic Action for a Just Economy, a tenant rights and housing advocacy nonprofit based in South L.A. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up next, we turn our attention to the U.K. Prime Minister Theresa May made her presentation for the negotiated Brexit deal at Parliament, and there was so much pushback, they have delayed the vote. She knew she didn't have the votes. We'll hear some excerpts of what she had to say and question what comes next as the UK tries to exit the EU. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3. We'll be back in 1 minute. Coming up later this hour on Air Talk, we open up the phones for you to talk about your favorite house of worship when you traveled across the U.S. or around the world. So many beautiful places. During this holiday season, we thought we'd take some time so you can share with your fellow listeners some of the most moving experiences you've had at houses of worship, maybe a Hindu temple, a mosque, beautiful church, or a synagogue that had a great power when you visited. It could be architectural, the design of it, the history associated with it, the setting of the house of worship. That's coming up right here on Air Talk. But right now we turn our attention to the UK, where today British Prime Minister Theresa May postponed the parliamentary vote on her administration's divorce deal known as Brexit. This the UK's efforts to separate from the European Union. Here's her announcement that she would delay the vote in front of the House of Commons.
We've now had 3 days of debate on the withdrawal agreement, setting out the terms of our departure from the EU and the political declaration setting out our future relationship after we have left. I've listened very carefully to what has been said in this chamber and out of it. To what has been said in this chamber and out of it by members from all sides. From listening to those views, it is clear that while there is broad support for many of the key aspects of the deal, on one issue, the Northern Ireland backstop, there remains widespread and deep concern. As a result, if we went ahead and held the vote tomorrow, the deal would be rejected by a significant margin. We will therefore defer the vote scheduled for tomorrow and not proceed to divide the House at this time.
Whatever you think of Brexit, you can't say she's not a poised speaker. Theresa May went on to reiterate her support for Brexit and said both sides are going to have to give something.
I believe in it, as do many members of this House. And I still believe there is a majority to be won in this House in support of it, if I can secure additional reassurance on the question of the backstop. And that is what my focus will be in the days ahead. But, Mr. Speaker, if you take a step back, it is clear that this House faces a much more fundamental question. Does this House want to deliver Brexit? A clear message from the SNP, but if the House does it want to do so through reaching an agreement with the EU? If the answer is yes, and I believe that is the answer of the majority of this House, then we all have to ask ourselves whether we're prepared to make a compromise, because there will be no enduring and successful Brexit without some compromise on both sides of the debate.
Theresa May addressing the House of Commons earlier today. I wish our Congress were that entertaining to listen to or to watch. With us, a Washington correspondent for the BBC, Gary O'Donoghue. He had been chief political correspondent for the BBC in London. Gary, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Larry. It's a pleasure.
Very dramatic to hear what happened today in Parliament. So what comes next? They've done the negotiation, and then the head of the EU, I read, said about an hour ago that, you know, they weren't looking to renegotiate this. What happens now?
Well, frankly, Larry, anyone that tells you they know what exactly happens next is lying, because this is really uncharted territory for everyone involved. It is surprise after surprise, and there's no rule book, and there's no map guiding us on this one. But it's pretty complex. So let me try and unpick it a little bit for you.
Yeah.
It's worth bearing in mind in the British system that the Prime Minister, Theresa May, she derives her authority, her mandate, if you like, from having a majority in the House of Commons, being able to get things through the House of Commons, through Parliament. And that's why she's Prime Minister, because she commands that majority of her own members of Parliament, plus a few others in the Commons. So not being able to put a vote that you know you're going to lose is a serious undermining of her authority as leader of the country. That's the first thing to say. It's a difference, if you like, between what we have here in the States in terms of the presidency being one thing and Congress being another. In Britain, the Prime Minister and Parliament are intimately interwoven in terms of their authority. So that's the first thing to say. Now, what she's done, she's negotiated this divorce deal with the EU. It's really the first stage of Brexit. In other words, it's just, what do we do to disentangle ourselves? How much money do we pay to them? What are the arrangements? It's nothing to do with any kind of future trade deal. That hasn't even been thought about at this stage. And the big issue that's always plagued the negotiation is the one land border between the UK outside the EU and the EU itself. And that land border occurs in the island of Ireland. And as you know, the island of Ireland is split. 32 counties, 26 of them are part of the Irish Republic, a sovereign nation, a separate nation, an EU member state in its own right, and 6 of those counties on the island of Ireland are part of the UK. This is the historic split, if you like, between Protestants and Catholics that took place at the beginning of the 20th century. And the difficulty is, if you're outside the EU and you've got this land border, what do you do about it? Well, normally you'd build customs posts and border posts, wouldn't you, to regulate the traffic and the flow of goods across. But no one wants a hard border on the island of Ireland, in many ways, because the economies there are so interlinked. People travel across that border every day for work and for family reasons. And crucially, that open border is absolutely tied in with the Irish peace agreement, the Good Friday peace agreement signed back in, when was it, 1998, 20 years ago. It's a symbol, if you like, of the end of the troubles, that open border. And if they can't agree this divorce deal, then the chances are this hard border returns, and no one wants that. And that is the problem. So what will happen now, effectively, if she gets her way and this is voted through eventually, there'll be a two-year transition period where almost nothing will change. That can be extended a little bit. The problem is, after that, we've got this Irish backstop thing to deal with the border issue, and that is something that a lot of her own MPs don't like, because they say there is no way out of that backstop arrangement, which keeps Britain under some of the custom rules of the EU without the EU agreeing us to leave. So they want this backstop arrangement, if all else fails, to be struck out of the deal at the moment. I know it's really complicated, but it all comes down to this question of how you keep an open border when you've got two countries that are with one outside and one inside the European Union.
I'm not quite following what the other side is. So you've got the terms that were negotiated in May's divorce deal, but then what's the other side of what people want for Ireland?
Well, this is the issue. So the divorce deal she's got involves us paying $50 billion or so to the EU to settle out the money we owe. It involves this transition arrangement where we basically keep the rules that we've got for the next couple of years, maybe slightly longer. And the point is, during that transition period, we're meant to renegotiate a whole new trading arrangement with the EU, you know, in the same way as you've just renegotiated the trading arrangement that NAFTA was, or the one with the Canadians have just done with the EU, that sort of thing. Now, the difficulty is, what happens if in that transition period there isn't a deal reached? This is where this backstop arrangement kicks in. And this is the thing that the Brexiteers, the people who want to leave the EU cleanly, don't like, because they believe that puts us into a kind of limbo where we're subject to a lot of the arrangements on the island of Ireland, you know, customs arrangements because of the open border, but and therefore won't be in a position to negotiate external trade deals with the rest of the world. So the options now are these, really. Theresa May can go back to Brussels, as she said she's going to do, and try and get some more reassurances on how much latitude Britain has to get out of this backstop arrangement if it comes into play. Or she could do that, and it could be voted down in the House of Commons, and Britain could crash out of the EU on the 29th of March next year with no deal whatsoever, in which case it's very likely that a hard border would have to go straight up in Ireland anyway. Or there could be a general election, which Theresa May could suddenly decide. Or the other option, which a lot of people want in Britain, or at least a vocal number of people want in Britain, is a second referendum, asking the question again that they asked back in 2016. And there's a lot of pressure against that, because in Europe there's been a bit of a history of governments not getting the answer they like on referendums and then just asking people again until they do get the answer they like.
Gary, I need to break, but just real briefly, is there a concern that if a hard border goes into effect on the island, that you'd have unrest in Ireland as a result of that?
Yeah, I think this is a psychological thing in many ways. The sense is that is the biggest symbol of the success of the Irish peace agreement. That before, you had British soldiers guarding the roads that went in and out of Northern Ireland, and that this is a sign that peace had returned, this open border, because, of course, the IRA used to come from the south and make its way across the border to make a lot of its attacks. So that is something people... But it's also an economic issue, because there's £4 billion, sort of $6 billion worth of trade goes across that border every year. It's a lot of money, a lot of family ties. Some of the farms even cross the border there, Larry. You know, one bit in one side, one bit in the other. So, you know, it's a very, very interwoven place, if you like.
Picturing daily milk deliveries going back
exactly.
and forth across the border. Gary, thank you so much. Really appreciate your sharing your observations. Gary O'Donohue with us, BBC Washington correspondent with us. It's Air Talk coming up. We'll ask you for some of your best experiences visiting houses of worship across the country and around the world. Regardless of faith, regardless of type of house of worship, we're talking about some of your favorites at 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back right after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdy's. Last week, in watching the state funeral for the 41st President, George H.W. Bush, it reminded me of how beautiful Washington National Cathedral is, that Episcopal Church, which is such a symbol sitting up on the hill there. Beautiful house of worship. Made me think of all the other beautiful houses of worship that I've seen traveling the United States or traveling other parts of the world. A few years ago, going to Istanbul and seeing the Hagia Sophia, which was the Greek Orthodox patriarchal cathedral and then became a mosque and is now a museum, just so much history there, or the Sultan Ahmed, known as the Blue Mosque, just a short distance away there in Istanbul, and all the incredible history from that mosque, the beautiful cathedrals, of course, of Europe. So I'd like to hear from you. You know, maybe you found a gym, maybe it was just, you know, it was a little church or a temple or synagogue, something that you found that was particularly meaningful. I know for myself, traveling in Central Europe and seeing, you know, the effects of World War II and the Holocaust and Jewish neighborhoods that were wiped out, and only to see synagogues come back beautifully reconstructed and restored because of, and not just Jewish community, but others in the community coming forward to financially support the reconstruction of the synagogue. Symbolically and spiritually, which houses of worship, as you've traveled, have had a strong influence on you? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Donna, in the city of Orange, which one stands out to you?
King's College in Cambridge, England.
King's College. And describe it for us if we haven't been there.
It's just absolutely beautiful. The stained glass is wonderful. They have the Adoration of the Magi as a centerpiece for, and the altar. And going to Christmas Eve service is magical.
All right. Thank you so much, Donna. King's Chapel, Cambridge University, 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Nicole writes on the page, La Sagrada Familia in Barcelona. I've gotten goosebumps, Nicole writes, both times I've visited. Just sitting there quietly is a spiritual experience for me. Nicole also cites the Kazan Cathedral in St. Petersburg, Russia. She says it's a close second. I lit a candle and was fortunate to be present when Mass began shortly after. Transcendent. Nicole, on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org or 866-893-KPECC. John, in Highland Park, what have you visited recently or over the years, a house of worship that stood out to you?
The new cathedral in St. Louis, which is a misnomer because it's about 100 years old, and they are still actually building it. But the really incredible feature, it's done like a Byzantium church, like St. Mark's in Venice.
Yeah.
So it has that big towering dome in the middle. And the entire church is done with Tiffany glass. It is done with tiny shards of glass, so that all of the aisles are mosaics that are absolutely spectacular. And the central mosaic in the middle is Christ resurrected with about a 70-foot-tall Jesus, which seems to be in proper perspective no matter what angle you look at it from the church.
Wow.
Even though it's over 100 feet tall in the air, and it is rounded both up and to the sides. It's an absolutely spectacular work of art. The entire church is just phenomenal. I'd never heard of it until I went to St. Louis, and just happened to go there for, you know, like I saw the old church and the new one, and it was absolutely spectacular.
John, I appreciate your sharing that. John in Highland Park, the cathedral in St. Louis, 866-893-KPCC. Greg in downtown L.A. has one of our local treasures he wants to talk about.
Hi, Larry. Thanks. Yeah, you know, the Self-Realization Center down on Sunset and PCH, one day I wandered in there and was just amazed. Not only is the temple itself, but it is one of the most beautiful gardens in town. It's non-denominational, and I attend service there sometimes with my children who find it inspiring and not dogmatic at all. And it is really just a wonderful little paradise down
there. A real retreat in the middle of the city. And I found out, Greg, just a little over a week ago from our Film Week critic, Wade Major, who knows a lot about Hollywood history, that was part of a very early studio that did Westerns. It was, you know, for like one of those filming ranches before becoming the Self-Realization Center. I hadn't realized that. Greg, thank you so much for your call. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. James in Pasadena wants to point out a place that I visited year before last, the Jewish-Spanish Synagogue in Prague. The acoustics are amazing. We heard the Czech orchestra play there. Yeah, James, it is absolutely gorgeous. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Lise, in Venice, what have you seen in your travels in the house of worship that affected you?
Hi, Larry. So I was traveling along the path of the ancient Silk Road, and I came to the city of Samarkand, which is famous for its Registan, which is a square with three buildings on three sides. I got up very early in the morning trying to catch a photograph of the gorgeous tiles as the sun rose. I got there, and it was gated and locked. There was a guard who waved to me. He flashed 10 with his fingers. I paid him $10. He unlocked the gate. He led me to the far side of the square, to one of the buildings, to a door halfway up a wall, let me through the door. We went up a narrow stairwell, circular stairwell, led me to another level, opened a door to a dark attic, and pointed across the way to a light I could barely see, and hinted for me, go that way, go that way. I walked across this dark attic with all the wooden beams, you know, over my head, got to the far side, and there was a narrow brick circular stair going up, 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 up. Wow. Narrower and narrower.
Did you get a little nervous at this point?
I'm sorry?
Did you get a little nervous at this point?
I was terrified. Well, he closed the door behind me when I went into the attic, and I thought, oh no, what have I done? But I went up there, and when I got to the top, I stuck my head out of the top, and just at that moment, the sun rose across the city. It was spectacular.
It sounds like a transcendent view. Lise, thank you for sharing that experience traveling the old Silk Road, 866-893-KPECC, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Miles in Claremont says Westminster Abbey in London. Diana's funeral was there. They have monuments and crypts that go back over 1,000 years. Incredible history, Westminster Abbey in London. We'll take more of your thoughts. Diana in San Bernardino says, in Lake Arrowhead, there's a church called Our Lady of the Lake Parish. The entire wall behind the altar is made of glass and shows a beautiful garden with white statues. I remember entering the church during a snowfall, seeing the garden behind the altar covered in snow. Such a serene experience. 866-893-KPCC. What experience visiting a house of worship across the country or across the world made the biggest impact on you? Back in just 1 minute.
Alan in Valley Village says, I visited the Baha'i Temple in Haifa, Israel. There's an exact duplicate built in Illinois, and both are beautiful. Sam in Thousand Oaks says, my favorite place of worship, the Hindu temple in Malibu. Beautiful scenic area in the middle of the Malibu Mountains and stands out from the landscape. Yeah, I've driven by that. It is gorgeous, Sam, absolutely. Maria shares on the Air Talk Facebook page, Casa de Maria in Montecito. The most incredible tiny chapel, so deep and inspiring. I think maybe four people could fit in it. I hope it's still there. Wow, that is a tiny chapel. Maria, thank you so much. Rob says, Paleolithic caves and cave art are the most awe-inspiring religious structures. Marks the beginning of mankind's ability to convey through art the meaning of existence. Some of these paintings look as though they were painted yesterday. The fact some are over 40,000 years old makes it even more impressive. That's Rob on the Air Talk page. Let's see. We have next Brian in Glendale. Brian, what house of worship stands out to you?
The All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. It's a gorgeous church, but more importantly, I was there on the Sunday after 9/11, and it was an incredibly moving and emotional experience to be with a bunch of Manhattanites going through what we went through on that that horrible, you know, day and the weeks that followed. So it was just a really awe-inspiring, emotional, raw type experience, and I'll never forget it.
The late pastor of that church, All Souls Unitarian, a guest that we had on Air Talk when we went 3 months after the September 11th attacks, we went to New York broadcast for a week in Midtown Manhattan, and he joined us. I wish I could remember his name. He's since passed, but was an extraordinary guest and just beautifully captured the spiritual challenge that New York City was experiencing at that time. And in fact, we had him on the show when he came out to visit to Los Angeles later. So, Brian, I can understand the impact of what you heard sitting in that church. 866-893-KPCC. Let's talk with Pupak in Santa Monica. Hi, Pupak.
Yes. I'm actually in Santa Ana. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So for me, as one of your listeners actually shared, the Baha'i House of Worship in Wilmette, Illinois, actually is perhaps one of the most beautiful houses of worship that I have seen. It's near Lake Michigan, and from what I understand, there are 10 or 11 around the world, but the one for the North America continent is in Wilmette, Illinois.
All right. And it has a bunch of different entrances that are ornate?
It does. It you know, one of the concepts of a Baha'i House of Worship is that it is open for worship to the peoples of the world, regardless of your faith and background. So these nine entrances that all the temples have, all the Baha'i temples have around the world, signify that it is a welcoming place to people of all walks of life.
Pupak, thank you for sharing that. It's great to have two people talk about the Baha'i temples and the significance of those. Forrest Church was the pastor, late pastor of All Souls Unitarian. So thank you, Matt D'Angelo Antonio, finding that for us. Let's see, Susan, in West Los Angeles, houses of worship that have had a greatest effect on you and your travels.
Yes. Hi. My daughter and I just got back from India, and we were in Varanasi, India, and I would say that it's a subtle and very profound transformation that happens in your heart, in your soul, observing the thousands upon thousands of pilgrims who go to their shrines and temples. And then we were on the Ganges River, and the Ganges itself is sacred, and observing Chhat Puja, which is a Hindu homage to the sun, people who are there camping out, and I'm saying thousands in their colorful saris and
wow,
their music. And
I've seen films of that. I can't imagine what it's like to be there as it's taking place.
It was profoundly moving, and I am not Hindu. I'm not Buddhist.
You wouldn't have to be moved by it, though.
No.
Susan, I appreciate it so much. Thank you for sharing about your very recent trip. Mike in Tarzana says, the synagogue at the U.S. Naval Academy in Maryland, it's built like an upside-down ship out of white timber and very conducive to prayer. Mike, thank you. I had no idea. Tanya, writing on our Facebook page, says, the Golden Temple in Amritsar, India, as a young traveler, I visited this golden temple in the middle of a lake. And as I was sitting on a bench taking my shoes off, a father came up to me with his young son, smiled deeply at me, bent down and kissed my feet. I had no idea what it meant, but brought me to tears. That's Tanya writing on our AirTalk Facebook page. Valerie in Tustin has a local treasure. Go ahead, Valerie.
It's the Church of the Epiphany in Lincoln Heights. It was built in the late 1880s by the same gentleman who did the Riverside Mission End.
Wow.
It's this little gem in East L.A.
And it was built before the turn of the century?
Yes.
Okay. Before the turn of the 20th century. I have to always qualify that now. Valerie, thank you. I need to check that out. So what's it called again? Church of the Epiphany? All right. Okay.
Church in East L.A.
All right. Very good. I'll check that out. Thanks so much. Let's see. Rebecca in Pasadena. Rebecca, your favorite house of worship.
Hi. Yes, I was in Russia about 10 years ago, Nizhny Novgorod, which is Gorky's place, and the state did not have enough money to rebuild all of the churches, so they were massively rebuilding them, the Orthodox churches. And so what communities were doing were locating churches that they didn't even realize were churches. And I was at one that actually had been made into a bread factory. They discovered it's a church. The whole community was digging it out themselves. And by the time I got there, they had redone and revealed the paintings in the sacristy, which actually was where they baked the bread, which is ironic.
Oh, wow. It is.
Yeah.
So you witnessed them digging that all. Oh, that's Rebecca. Thank you. I wish I had more time to get into that more detail, but appreciate it. Carol Ann and Torrance wanted to talk about, of course, the Frank Lloyd Wright designed Wayfarer's Chapel in Palos Verdes. Larry in Pasadena says National Cathedral took my son there after eighth grade. Had a great impact on me because my son's grandmother had just died. He has to light a candle for her. It is beautiful, a true treasure, the National Cathedral in Washington. And it was seeing that on TV with George H.W. Bush's state funeral that gave me the idea we should do this on the program. Rafael tweets at AirTalk, in Mexico City, the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe, which has the original robe depicting the Virgin Mary worn by Juan Diego, brought me to tears, a must-see for its architecture and beauty. Robin Hollywood, the Rothko Chapel in Houston, says Mark Rothko design, which is extraordinary. Thank you for sharing your favorites at houses of worship here in Southern California, across the country, and around the world. Have a great afternoon.